Good morning, distinguished panel, guests, Generals Davis, Gelzo, and Rutstein, professors, and fellow students. I'm Pete Barille, symposium editor of the Connecticut Law Review, and on behalf of the Law Review, I welcome you to the 1999 Wiggin and Dana Symposium. Today we'll be discussing this year's other trial of the century, United States versus Microsoft. In 1998, the United States Department of Justice and 20 states attorneys general brought a civil antitrust action against one of the most powerful and successful companies in American history, Microsoft. Although this is not the first time the government and Microsoft have litigated antitrust issues, this case may have the potential to be the most significant. The comparisons have been drawn between the Microsoft case and the Standard Oil case from the beginning of the century, with Bill Gates being cast as the modern John D. Rockefeller. While Microsoft critics fear that if unchecked, Microsoft will become the gatekeeper of the Internet with the dominance of its web browser, Microsoft defenders fear that a government victory in this case will ruin an American success story and suppress innovation in the software and computer fields. At the present time, the trial is in the middle of a six-week hiatus, and rumors of a possible settlement are afoot. Now, before I pass the mic to Dean McGill, on behalf of the Law Review, I wish to thank the law firm of Wiggin and Dana, whose generous support has made this event possible. I'd also like to thank our wonderful panel, to whom you will be introduced shortly, as well as individually, our moderator, Bob Langer of Wiggin and Dana, and Professor Orlin. Their guidance has been invaluable in putting together this symposium. So without further ado, Dean of the Law School, Hugh McGill.
Thank you, Pete. I want to add, on behalf of the entire school, our welcome, our thanks to Wiggin, our thanks to the panelists, and our thanks to you, Pete, and Lisa, and the Board of Editors of the Law Review for the remarkable number of entirely uncompensated hours that you put into putting this one together. It's excellent training for next year, where somebody may actually pay you for the work once they know that you're accustomed to doing without a great deal of sleep. Very reassuring to employers, I think. I have to admit to some institutional bias with respect to the litigation of the discussion of today's, the subject of today's discussion. My secretary said as I was coming over here, don't let them let Gates get away with it. As I will stop by or going in and out of the office, she will be sitting at in front of her computer with her shoulders slumped despondently, trying to get the machine to do something, and she can't figure out how to, and it's now known in the office as a Bill Gates moment. But rising above to general principle, this is a wonderful opportunity, I think, of intellectual nature for the panelists, participants, the audience, and for this academic community. I am old enough, and indeed many of the people in this room are old enough, to remember that period when antitrust law seemed to be about to be subsumed into legal history. We had, and still do have, two specialists in antitrust law in the faculty. We were thinking of letting one of them go because there simply wasn't any antitrust litigation. That has changed. I understand that there's some anxiety that a settlement may be announced in this case, yea, even this morning. Don't worry, orders have been given throughout not to accept any calls from Washington, and if it does happen, you won't know about it until the day is done. But in an important sense, it almost doesn't matter whether this case is settled or not, because the issues that it raises and the problems that it involves, not only in antitrust law as a technical area of legal specialization, but also the economic phenomenon of Microsoft, and the relation of legal regulation to entrepreneurial activity, whether regulation in any form, be it through litigation, be it through legislation, is always going to be a day late, a dollar short, is one of the problems that as a society we must continually consider, reckon with, and ponder. Settlements come, cases, settlements go, cases are brought, cases are won, cases are lost. The problems, however, which they reflect, abide. And even if you are mooted as to this case in the course of this very day, there is still so much to worry about, so much to think about, and so much to consider that this will have been a perfectly splendid opportunity for us all, even if Bill Gates gets off scot-free. I'm delighted to introduce as moderator Bob Langer, who Is it currently a partner at Wigan & Dana as head of their antitrust and trade regulation practice group, having worked for many years as the principal in the Connecticut Attorney General's office on antitrust and consumer protection, who served as chair of the National Association of Attorney General Multi-State Antitrust Task Force earlier in this decade before going into private practice. His credits are numerous, including advisory board of the BNA Antitrust and Trade Regulation Report, board of editors of Matthew Bender Antitrust Report, and he himself is the author of a two-volume treatise on one of the great blunderbuss state statutes, the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, out of which he made a living for a number of years. I joined this faculty in 1971, which is very nearly before the flood. And Bob was, nominally at least, a student of mine in a seminar my first year in the faculty. I wouldn't want to think too carefully now as to who was teaching whom, but the relation has continued with great pleasure on my part for many years, and I'm glad to have it continue today, as I expect to learn more from him now, even than in the past. Bob?
And we look the same as we do today, Hugh. Yeah, it's quite remarkable. My firm in particular welcomes you. We are really privileged to be able to put on this symposium. All of the credit, however, belongs to the Connecticut Law Review, who did all of the work, in particular Peter Burrill and Danielle Ferrucci, who are the symposium editors, deserve enormous credit for first attracting such extraordinary group of speakers. Having practiced in antitrust for over 25 years, to assemble this group is really terrific, and I'm sure it will lead, whether the case settles or not, to quite significant debate regarding the future of antitrust in this country. I want to acknowledge, as Peter has, one of my great friends, Steve Rutstein, who is the head of the Antitrust Consumer Protection Department in Connecticut, has played a central role not just in Microsoft litigation, but in multi-state cases throughout the last 20 years. And Steve and I worked together forever. Lynn Gelzo and Rachel Davis are also assistant attorneys general are here. And if I can draw them out later, one of us can draw them out regarding the state-federal issue, which I'm hopefully will get addressed sometime during the day of the symposium. I hope that will occur. By the way, unfortunately, Professor Harry First of NYU will not be speaking today, and he will not be speaking not because he's ill, but because he has taken a position as head of the Antitrust Bureau in the New York State Attorney General's office under new Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, and thought it would be inappropriate for him at this point, considering New York's central role in the matter, to speak on the subject, since he has actually not taken his position yet. In addition, Will Roger of Interactive Week unfortunately called yesterday and is quite ill and could not make the trip, and that is also unfortunate. I will try to, despite my the fact that I've been a professor for 20-something years as well and tend to ramble off at the mouth, will try not to do that and to maintain my moderator role. My partner, David Fine, is, if you've read the program, is special investigative counsel to the Antitrust Division in the Microsoft matter, and while we do have a firewall between us and we don't discuss the matter, it would be, I think, safer for me to ask questions rather than try to even opine upon answers. Let me just raise possible issues that could be discussed today from our panelists in just a minute or two, and then I'm going to get out of the way. Peter mentioned, you know, cases of the century. I think one of the questions is, you know, is Microsoft one of the cases of the century, equaling in importance cases such as Standard Oil and Alcoa, or is it a blip? I mean, is it important substantively, or is it only important in this particular market? And I think the questions are not clear. The question is clear. The answer is not at all clear. Can and should existing antitrust jurisprudence be applied to high technology markets in which Microsoft and its competitors operate? Is there something different about barriers to entry, about entrenchment, about the exertion of market power with regard to high tech? Or is it simply the same as steel and oil and tobacco and any number, and aluminum ingots or any number of other cases? If Microsoft, and this isn't a subjunctive, Rick, were found to have violated the law, is there an antitrust remedy available to the court? And if so, is such a remedy likely to make the market more competitive or not? At least two of the speakers today, Professors Kvasik and Zittrain, are going to specifically address those issues, and I expect others in the dialogue we're going to have at the end of the morning and the afternoon to do the same. What impact is the Microsoft case likely to have upon future coordinated federal-state antitrust enforcement? There is the highest level of coordinated activity between the state and federal enforcers in the history of this country. Is that likely to continue? What effect will Microsoft have? Can we not know that until the case is over, or is this portend the future of what I've suggested in some articles of my own about a more formalized allocation of responsibility between various sovereigns? And finally, in my favorite question, which is only done in I preface this as not to become incendiary or to incite a riot, but to raise this following question. It is well known that Section 2 of the Sherman Act prohibits both acts of monopolization and attempts to monopolize, and the speakers will speak about that today. It's less well known that Sherman 2 is a criminal statute in which an individual, as you may not know, is subject to imprisonment for up to 3 years, and a corporation is subject to a fine of up to $10 million. And so the clever question, which doesn't really do justice to the issue, is could, and if so, should the antitrust division have sought the indictment and conviction of Bill Gates? The real question is there a role for criminal enforcement in the area of monopolization? And unfortunately, having known Rick Rule as I have and known his writings in the area, both when he was head of the antitrust division and afterwards, he's actually thought deeply about those issues and opined upon those questions. What the format's going to be is we're going to have speakers this morning. I've spoken to each about not doing extended introductions, in part because the law review has been kind enough to include the bio sketches. But I do just want to just introduce the panel briefly, and including the speakers that are in the audience who will come up at the end of the morning in time for the panel discussion. Bert Fohr is president of the American Antitrust Institute, an independent non-profit think tank that was just founded in 1998 and has already had a quite significant impact in this country. I know personally because one of my clients, who I've mentioned to Bert will remain anonymous, asked me in the course of an evaluation of an appellate court decision we were looking at, what's the likelihood that we'd find Bert as an amicus in this matter? And so he obviously has gotten on the radar screens of some very large companies very quickly. Bill Kvasik is professor of law at the George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C. I've known him for many years. He is one of the finest speakers I've ever come across and is extraordinarily thoughtful, and looking forward to his comments, particularly about remedies. My friend Rick Rule, who was head of the antitrust division from 1986 to 1989, and we worked, despite all of the conventional wisdom to the contrary, worked extremely well together during that period of time in a vast array of matters, is a partner in Covington and Burling now and head of its antitrust and trade regulation practice group, and will speak about whether Microsoft has in fact violated the law, and his firm does represent the company. Professor Leonard Orland, who was my mentor when I went here, the only reason I ever got involved in antitrust was because of him, and I owe him a debt of gratitude, or some businesses probably think from my prior life they should never have been introduced to him, but he has been teaching antitrust law here at and other courses at UConn for many years, and is widely known and respected for his authorship of an extraordinary array of books. And he's going to deal with a very interesting topic about how you teach Microsoft during the course of litigation, which he did, and I'm very pleased that Lenny could be on the panel. Very briefly, Bob Levy is in the audience. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and he has a particular view about the role of antitrust, is very thoughtful on this subject, and I expect that there may be some differences of opinion regarding his views and those of others. And I'm extremely pleased that he agreed to speak here today. Professor William Page, professor of law at the Mississippi College School of Law, is front row here, and again, it's a privilege that he was able to be here today, and had a tenure in the antitrust division, and has written extensively on these subjects. Jonathan Zutrain, I used to see well, there he is, executive director of the Berkman Center, if you could just raise your hand, but you'll be up here later. He is executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. And again, he has thought deeply about these issues, and we are fortunate that he's here and look forward to his presentation. And I'm going to get out of the way and allow Bert Ford to take over.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning. It's a pleasure to have an opportunity to pontificate. We're going to talk about the importance of the Microsoft case as a kind of a framework, and I'll do my best to stay within a reasonable amount of time. You can help me if you'll just keep your eye on that clock and let me know when 20 minutes have passed. I don't think we can talk about the importance of this case without talking about the future. Futurists tell us that it's a mistake to predict a future as if there were only one future. Actually, there are lots of possible futures. And so the way that we're going to work on this is to develop six scenarios of the future with regard to the Microsoft case and its impact on antitrust. It's always dangerous to predict the future. When the weatherman says there's a 50% chance of rain, he really can't go wrong, no matter what happens. Only if you're dumb enough to say it's 100% chance of something are you likely to be proven wrong. So we'll stay away from 100%. And in a little bit, I'll offer you my own odds on things. But right now, let's lay out several different scenarios. One scenario will be that Microsoft wins the case. The other will be that the government wins the case. And within each of these frameworks, I want to develop rationalizations for how I arrive at my own predictions. Let's take a moment, though, to give you some background. If Microsoft were to win the case, basically, four findings would have to be made by the court. Let me say also, in the event that a settlement occurs, you'll try to place the settlement into the framework of the six scenarios. It'll probably fit into one or another of the six, and probably neither of the ones at the extremes. To win the case, you've got four separate claims made by the government. Two of them involve Section 1 of the Sherman Act, illegal restraints of trade, unreasonable restraints of trade, and two involve monopolization. If Microsoft won a total victory, the trial court would find that there are no facts, insufficient facts, to sustain these four claims. They'd have to say Microsoft did not willfully maintain its monopoly power in the market for PC operating systems. And Microsoft did not willfully attempt to monopolize and to destroy effective competition in the Internet browser market through a course of conduct that includes tying and unreasonable exclusionary agreements. And three, Microsoft did not enter into exclusionary agreements that unreasonably restrain trade. And four, Microsoft did not unlawfully tie its internet browser product to its separate monopoly Windows operating system product. Okay, those are the four challenges that the government has put forth. In our first set of scenarios that Microsoft wins, Microsoft would be left free to engage in three different kinds of areas, at least. One, to engage in agreements that its competitors view as exclusionary, not only its competitors, but a lot of objective observers or third-party observers. In the trial, just to give you a little more background on that particular item, the exclusionary agreements, in the trial, the government presented evidence, for example, that Microsoft entered agreements with AOL and Intuit, whereby their products would be well-placed on the Microsoft desktop, which is considered strategically important, in return for their using the Microsoft Internet Explorer, the Microsoft browsing product, with the result that this would exclude competitors, such as Netscape. And they also entered into agreements with Apple, whereby Microsoft would continue to develop Microsoft Office for the Mac, which was Apple's major product, in return for Apple's agreement to make the Internet Explorer the default browser on all Mac operating systems. That's the type of evidence that was offered with respect to the exclusionary agreements. The second area that Microsoft would be free to work in is to incorporate what could be standalone application software into its operating system. Now, in the trial, the government presented evidence that the Internet Explorer and Windows, which is Microsoft's operating system, may be referred to as OS during the course of the day, that they are separate products, that the sale of the OS, a product with appreciable economic power in the market, was conditioned on the sale of the Internet Explorer, the browser, and that tying them together offered no benefit that could not be achieved by customers putting the two together themselves or by combining Windows with some other browser. And the third area that they would be allowed to do, they'd be allowed to bundle applications with the operating system at what appears to be a zero price. And in the trial, the government presented evidence that Microsoft, which it declares is a monopolist, and it presented some evidence showing that it's a monopolist, that they sold the operating system and the browser together, which is to say bundled, at a single price, namely the price of the operating system, such that the software was given away, and that it would recover its costs on this through a high price for the operating system. As a monopolist, it could set the price for the operating system. Since a competing software producer presumably needs to earn a positive return on each unit of software that it sells, the argument is that giving away the Internet browser effectively prevents entry into the browser market and therefore illegally maintains the operating system monopoly. Okay, that's the background of what Microsoft would be able to do if they win a complete victory. Now, in our first scenario, competition reigns. Microsoft wins the case, but it turns out that Bill Gates was right. Remember, he's talked about all these competitors who are either real or potential that are lurking, I would say, in his anxiety closet, but maybe they're real. And if they are real, maybe Linux and Java and AOL Netscape can accomplish a miraculous growth into a new paradigm, and lo and behold, within a short time after the case goes away, the market becomes far more competitive than it ever was. We would see a vigorously competitive operating system market and lots of innovation, prices going down. Microsoft would suffer the same kind of fate that IBM suffered after its trial and when it got away at the end of the trial without a conclusion to the trial. Justice walked away from it. Nonetheless, IBM fell back into the pack. So that would be the competition reigns scenario. And the historians who are reporting this in the future, they don't report whether or not Bill Gates gives up his lakefront home and goes on welfare. We just don't know what turns out there. So let's move to another scenario in which the monopoly from hell becomes entrenched. This is your worst case kind of scenario of what happens if Microsoft wins. And basically, Microsoft wins in court. It marches on from victory to victory, strength to strength. It quickly takes over the enterprise market, which is probably going to be a bigger market than the personal computer market. That's the market for networks in businesses and organizations, which right now is pretty competitive and not dominated by Microsoft. Microsoft has a plan, which they've announced, to move forward into that area very strongly, and people in that area fear that that will be one of the outcomes, that Microsoft will replicate its monopoly with PCs. It would continue, Microsoft would continue to learn from its competitor's software and make its own versions. It would bundle these with the operating system, price them at zero, and drive out competitors. The Department of Justice would become thoroughly demoralized. Its budget would be slashed by Congress amid charges of government waste and interference with the American technology juggernaut. State attorneys general would become quiet, having learned that big but unsuccessful antitrust cases curry little favor with the voters. Microsoft would continue to build its content providing business. Within a few years, it would dominate operating systems and applications and be in control or gaining control over new delivery technologies, such as handheld computers, TV internet interfaces, voice recognition. When computers are turned on all over the world, the first thing that would go on the screen would be what Microsoft wanted to put on the screen. It would control the order in which browsers report information. It would begin to dominate in the content of what goes on the internet as well. With its billions and billions of dollars of cash, it can buy up all kinds of different players. And in fact, Time magazine in the year 2005 called Bill Gates the most powerful individual in the whole history of the universe. By that time, financiers would stop investing in companies or products which were not fully sanctioned by Microsoft. Innovation would be completely channeled into products that Microsoft wanted to introduce. Prices of Microsoft products, of course, would go up. And Microsoft, dominating electronic commerce, would be getting a small transaction fee on a substantial and growing portion of the world's commercial transactions. Eventually, a political reaction would set in. It won't get very far in this country because Microsoft would dominate our political system through its campaign contributions and charitable contributions all around the country. But on the international scene, various countries would start taking action. Now, in the third scenario, it's a little bit different. What happens here, I call it, we didn't get the monopoly from hell exactly, we got the oligopoly from heck. This would be the reaction of Microsoft's competitors in the larger computer community who get together as an alliance, possibly a couple of alliances. They don't compete head-on with Microsoft. They compete around the edges, and they have a very major presence, and they do everything they can, either as one closely coordinated alliance or maybe a couple of alliances. Maybe they shift, members shift around from time to time. It wouldn't be real competition, but it would be some sort of a limiting presence. So let's turn now to the next set of scenarios where the government wins. Well, the first possibility, of course, is what we all recognize as a term of art. It's not in Black's legal dictionary. It's called the judge wimps out. Government wins the case, shows liability, but there is no significant remedy. Everybody knows the remedy is nothing but a slap on the wrist. One possibility is that this could occur because the case bounces back and forth to the appellate levels for years and years. And even though the trial is rapid, the case doesn't get resolved for a better part of a decade. If that occurred, you might just end up with a totally pyrrhic victory. Microsoft loses on the law and wins in reality. Now, you could also have the government prevail, and the remedy that gets put into effect is a real loser. My scenario for that would be a remedy that's highly regulatory. That is probably a conduct-based remedy, one that requires intensive and long-enduring involvement by the judge, possibly with appeals going back and forth on various rulings. Everybody comes into court anytime anybody wants to do anything, and we end up with a de facto regulatory regime. The result of that would be that Microsoft becomes so bogged down that its energetic and creative people grow restless and they move on to some other companies, and Microsoft stock enters a long decline. And scholars, looking back, felt that the remediation of Microsoft was the turning point that led surprisingly quickly to the loss of American economic dynamism. On the other hand, while Microsoft's hands were tied by this regulatory regime, the rest of the industry had a lot of breathing room and the opportunity to flourish at Microsoft's expense. Finally, we have the scenario that the government wins and achieves its objective, competition reigns. This is the scenario in which the porridge is neither too hot nor too cold. The judge, the Justice Department, the Supreme Court, everybody gets it just right. And I won't tell you what that means. We'll worry about that later. But it means the outcome is a highly competitive, innovative industry, prices relatively low, and lots of players, a diversified computer industry. Okay, so what are the probabilities? Well, who knows? Go ahead, Arvin. This is what I think, and we can argue about this, and as we argue about it, we should try to explain what our reasons are. I think that Microsoft has about a one chance in three of winning. And I think the chance of winning at the trial is lower than that. But the appellate courts are not going to be inclined to be friendly to the government. On the other hand, I think that in the long run, a government victory will be sustained. So I give it about 1 out of 3 that Microsoft wins, 2 out of 3 that the government wins. If Microsoft wins, and the scenario of Microsoft wins, competition reigns, I don't think that's real likely. It doesn't matter what these numbers are. It's really a question of likelihood. I think that's unlikely that competition will reign if Microsoft wins this case. If Microsoft wins, what are the odds that we'll either get the monopoly from hell or the oligopoly from heck? Maybe 1 out of 4. Government wins, chances of either a Pyrrhic victory or that the remedy is a total loser, I think is kind of small. And that's an area where there's a lot of room for disagreement. Part of my reasoning is that I think as we get closer to figuring out exactly what the liability is, we won't know the liability until the courts tell us the liability. What's the rationale for developing a remedy? As we get closer to that, more and more attention will be focused on this issue. It has not been an issue in the trial, not one that's been developed yet. And there are a lot of folks out there who have knowledge, people in the industry on both sides. If Microsoft participates in the development of a remedy, probably get a more reasonable, workable remedy than if they don't. But we've got a good shot of getting there. Courts also have a way of going back and revisiting remedies to try to make sure that they do work. And in one major antitrust case, Supreme Court, 10 years later, after the initial injunction in the case, where it was a conduct remedy, the Supreme Court went back and said, that hasn't worked. We're going to make it into a structural remedy. And they did. So there's a lot of oversight. We've got a lot of experts. And this is an interesting case because so many people have had a chance to really get involved in the case on the outside that there's just a huge amount of information and analysis flowing in. But you could have a loser. That's possible. And then finally, you've got the possibility, which I think is the strongest possibility, of both a government victory and increased competition, a positive outcome to this whole thing. Let's go to the next slide. And just another way of reframing these same odds, in the event that Microsoft wins, I think that there's about a three-quarters chance that it'll be a negative outcome for competition. If the government wins, I think it's about three-quarters that competition will win. So, you know, if you carry your umbrella on a prediction like this, I think these are odds that that justify the government attempting to develop a strong positive remedy. Next. To try to summarize what I see as the importance of the Microsoft case based on this discussion, and I recognize that there are other issues that will be raised today. Some of them may well belong on this list, and some of these probably are not all that important, but let me run through them very quickly, again, to try to frame the conversation. I think that the viability of Section 2 of the Sherman Act in high technology industries is at stake, as Bob said. If Microsoft prevails, it'll be much more difficult to muster the political support for a large-scale monopolization case, particularly in a network environment, and particularly in industries that are undergoing relatively fast evolution. The concepts of essential facility and predation, I'm sure will be discussed later. I'm not going to get into them now. They may not appear as words in a judicial opinion, but these are the essential ideas in much of what this case is talking about. Whether these ideas gain more life in monopolization law or become further emasculated is one of the things that we will see. Tying arrangements. One of the interesting things here is going to be the extent to which courts are willing to get into the details of how an industry works, a high-tech industry. If you'll remember, the consent decree that immediately preceded this case, the question was whether Microsoft, in violation of a consent decree, had tied the operating system and the browser. And the appeals court for the District of Columbia, I think, in a way, punted on the issue. What they basically said was, if the monopolist in a complicated industry like this can show one reason, one feasible reason why consumers benefit from a tying or from considering the product to be an integrated product, a single product, that's good enough for us. We're not going to balance out any disadvantages that might be there for the economy or for the public or for competition. So whether that is the right way to approach this sort of thing will likely be determined in this case. And if balancing is not required, then it's going to be extremely difficult for plaintiffs to win technologically sophisticated tying cases. Number four, of course, is the remedy issue. If the government wins, the remedy will relate not so much to monetary damages, although monetary damages will be out there in the follow-on cases, the private cases. The important thing is the future structure and performance of what is surely among the world's most important industries. Over time, the case will demonstrate whether we can fashion and implement appropriate remedies in the context of high-tech industries. Now, the rest of this is comparatively unimportant, but let me mention them. As a procedural matter, the Microsoft case may tell us whether a monopolization case can be moved along fast enough to be relevant in a high-tech industry. You remember the IBM case went on for years and years, and a lot of people concluded that antitrust doesn't work. It's just too slow. But this trial was intentionally put on a fast track, and it has proceeded quickly through the limited number of witnesses that were permitted, and also by presenting direct testimony on paper and having the trial focus on cross-examination. The case may have some effect, breathing space, merely through its existence. That is to say, simply by bringing a case, forcing Microsoft to defend itself in public, to divert the attention of executives, and to bring a lot of facts into the public realm, that has had an impact already. You look at what the papers are reporting about a possible settlement on the focused on the exclusive agreements, and Microsoft is saying we're willing to stop doing what we've already stopped doing, which is what we stopped doing after the case became public. Two other points. I think that public relations is going to gain a whole new role in antitrust litigation. In cases after Microsoft, particularly also after Intel, where we had a very different strategy at work, public relations consultants are going to routinely supplement teams of lawyers and economists. You heard it here first. And finally, the electronic fingerprint problem is going to have to be resolved either by making it standard operating procedure to not put things in email in organizations that can imagine themselves as potential litigants, i.e. everybody. Or maybe we've identified a niche and somebody can go out there and figure out how to eliminate all traces of email from hard disks and from intervening computers all around the world. I don't know how that will come out, but certainly it's raised everybody's attention to the problem of email evidence. In summing up, I think that the Microsoft case may be deemed important simply because it's perceived to be important. For the first time in more than a generation, antitrust is discussed in homes and at cocktail parties and at symposiums, in part because of Bill Gates's extraordinary success and his talent for making enemies. And more importantly, I think it grows from the recognition that the nation is moving into a new era that will be dominated by the computer and the internet, and that a great deal depends upon whether that new era unfolds in a highly centralized or highly decentralized way. So competition policy, for so long ignored by the man on the street, has once again become relevant. Thank you.
We're not going to have question and answer now, but the question for Bert is, did he pick Gonzaga in the Final Four in terms of his odds, but in terms of his likelihood of success? Rick Rule.
I think he did. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to begin by thanking all those responsible for putting this program together. It is a first-class program. There are, as one can imagine, because of some of the things Bert said, the interest in this case, a lot of programs being held almost on a daily basis, if not weekly, on this subject. And I think the folks who put this together, the Law Review, the symposium editors, and with Wiggin and Dana's sponsorship, deserve a lot of credit for putting together a first-class program, and I think one of the better ones on this topic. And so I will listen with great interest to Bert and others as they speak and see what other people think. Let me just say briefly by way of background that, and in the interest of full disclosure, as Bob, who I want to echo, is also a good friend, and it's always good to see Bob, mentioned, my firm and I do represent Microsoft, and I am generally billed as a legal consultant to Microsoft. I'm not part of the trial team, but I have been in court probably 70% of the time that the trial has gone on, and essentially attempted to read all the transcripts when I haven't been there and the written testimony. So I have a pretty good idea, I don't want to say unlike others, but I have a pretty good idea of what's actually in the record. And I think as those of you who approach this case do so, it's important to be careful in focusing on what is actually in the record, as opposed to what is described by the press as being particularly exciting on a given day, or what some people may say in terms of summarizing the evidence. It's difficult, obviously, in a short period of time to summarize what the evidence is, because after all, it's been 6 months now that the evidence has gone in. And as I'll at least attempt to explain and be happy to talk a little more about, if one actually focuses on the record and one actually focuses on the legal standards that the government has to meet in order to carry its burden, the fact is that a prediction that Microsoft will lose is much like a prediction that Gonzaga will win the NCAA finals. I think it really fails to understand both where the law is and how the record has developed. To the extent, and this is the premise of what I want to say here this morning, to the extent that the government wins, and certainly that is, while I don't think the highest probability outcome here, there's always a probability that that can happen in any case, but for them to win, in effect, I think the legal standards that apply or that the courts have interpreted as applying under Section 2 will have to change. And in order for that change, or if that change comes about, I think it will significantly expand the role of the government intervening in markets. And to me, unlike apparently some other people, courts are part of the government. And to the extent that they are drawn increasingly into various disputes under the antitrust laws, you are increasing the role of government. Not to mention the fact that, as the folks who brought this case have said, they are hoping through this case to establish rules for the information industry. And Joel Klein, about a year ago, before the case was filed, went out to Silicon Valley and pretty much said that he hoped to establish this case and that other people in the industry ought to be aware that to the extent those rules are established, they too will have to live by it. So I suppose to the extent that small probability occurs and the government wins, the one pleasure that some of us can get out of this is watching people like Mike McNeely or Scott McNeely and other people in the industry, Steve Case, who agitated for this case, essentially being hoist on their own petard. Because, frankly, in almost every one of the cases in the industry, one can argue that the companies are in a similar position to Microsoft in their niche and have engaged in very similar practices, in some cases much more blatant. I'll just give you a little example. One of the issues that has come up periodically in the case is whether or not a Microsoft official ever said at a meeting with Intel that Microsoft intended to, quote, cut off Netscape's air supply, close quote. So far, there's no documented evidence that that occurred. The individual who is alleged to have said it denies it. Other people who were at the meeting, except for one disgruntled Intel employee, said he didn't say it. And when Jim Barksdale got up on the stand and they asked him, have you ever heard the phrase, cut off one's air supply, Barksdale, the head of Netscape, had to say, well, yes, I have. Well, where'd you hear that, Mr. Barksdale? He said, well, Larry Ellison of Oracle coined that phrase in talking about defeating one of his relational database competitors. And it sort of took on a currency out in Silicon Valley. And in fact, so you have this famous term, cut off their air supply, which it turns out Microsoft never said, but it was said by one of the companies that is the most vocal and active advocate for the case. And that is supposed to be a centerpiece of the government's evidence that Microsoft deserves to be bopped on the head. What I want to talk about briefly is, and then as somebody said, one of the things that we are expected to do here is not only speak for a few minutes, but also provide editable text. And so on that score, there will be more in editable form. But what I want to talk a little bit about is, first, are the appropriate standards to evaluate unilateral conduct. Because after all, what we are talking about here is the activities of an individual firm. And what makes the Microsoft case a little different, or at least one can say back to the future, something that really hasn't been around for about 15 to 20 years, is the fact that it is an attack basically on unilateral conduct. The antitrust laws, I think it is pretty clear in the courts today, are a statute that is designed, or a group of statutes that are designed to protect, promote, and maximize consumer welfare, which is essentially an economic concept, and describes the notion of, you can define it in various ways, total efficiency, maximizing output, maximizing total surplus in the market, but essentially making the maximum number of goods with society's scarce resources. And the notion is, of course, that you do that, that can happen in two ways. In a static sense, You try to increase productive or technical efficiency, which is the cost of producing a given good, and you try to maximize allocative efficiency, which is to say, ideally, in order to maximize allocative efficiency, all prices in the market would be equal to marginal cost. There would be no scarcity, at least no artificial scarcity. And it's really kind of that artificial scarcity or restriction of output that antitrust law is historically concerned about. But at least over the last 20 years, most of the focus of enforcement, most of the focus of the courts has been on horizontal agreements, agreements among competitors. And the reason for that is, I think, fairly simple. When you have competitors who otherwise would be slugging it out in the marketplace reaching an agreement, you have a risk that unless there are a number of other competitors out there or the agreement is structured correctly, a direct increase or enhancement of market power and therefore likelihood of decreasing output. But the reason, the other trend in this area in the courts is a recognition that simply because competitors have agreed, even if it may have or carry the threat of restricting output and raising price, it also may carry the benefit or the possibility of integrative efficiencies, increasing productive efficiency or technical efficiency. And so the courts, I think, have become a little better at identifying horizontal agreements and subjecting them to sound tests to evaluate their effect. And obviously, horizontal agreements range from per se illegal conduct, like price fixing, which is subject to criminal condemnation, to joint ventures, which are subject to the rule of reason, or what might probably best be called an ancillary restraints analysis, all the way to mergers, where it's pretty much a structural analysis that governs. But in all those cases, there is, to some extent, an implicit trade-off between the threat to allocative efficiency or output against the potential benefits of integrative efficiency. Unilateral conduct, on the other hand, is something that the courts understand they have to give wide berth to. And you can look at the Copperwell decision, which essentially eliminated the bathtub conspiracy theory that had prevailed before then. But there's an interesting discussion in that case by the Supreme Court of the distinction that the courts have drawn between joint conduct and unilateral conduct and recognize why we give unilateral conduct such wide berth. And primarily the reason is that in order for a marketplace to work, in order for markets to work effectively, we need to have individual persons, and that includes firms, going out there and acting on their incentive to maximize profit. And that profit maximization incentive drives folks to increase innovation, drives folks to improve the quality of their products, drives folks to lower prices towards marginal cost. And the danger of trying to interfere with that process is, one, anytime the government intervenes in the market, whether it's the courts or executive branch agencies, they impose certain costs just by their very nature of acting, but they also may send bad signals to the marketplace and that sort of thing, and they may get it wrong. And so we want to be very careful before we have government institutions supplanting consumer decisions or marketplace decisions. Moreover, we do have a history that we can see back, if you go far enough, of Section 2 cases that probably did get some things wrong, that probably did condemn conduct because of its immediate or apparent effect on competitors. But in the fullness of time and in retrospect, we realize, in fact, stopped conduct that had held the promise for increasing output, making consumers better off. And as a result of that, over the last 20 to 25 years, the courts have developed what I think is a fairly sound approach to looking at the question of monopoly or monopolization under Section 2. And Section 2 really is, with the exception of the Robinson-Patman Act, the one statute that addresses unilateral conduct. And under that statute, essentially, you have to show that a plaintiff has to show that a defendant first has monopoly power or a dangerous probability of obtaining monopoly power, and monopoly power is defined as the power to raise price or exclude competition from the marketplace. And that definition, courts increasingly have recognized, is not simply limited or is not simply established through market share because of the, if you will, imprecision of market definition and because of a variety of other factors that may affect monopoly power. But even if you can show that, as a plaintiff, that a defendant has monopoly power, that is not sufficient for the courts to intervene. The courts will not intervene on that basis alone. And the reason is that having encouraged people to go out and compete and succeed and maximize profits, as Learned Hand said in the Alcoa case, you can't really punish the winner, the person who does a good job of what we ask them to do. So the courts have created this distinction between lawful conduct that achieves or results in success, perhaps even monopoly, and illegal conduct, or what is known as willful monopolization. And that term willful is a little confusing. The best way to understand it, and the way the courts in the modern cases and most of the commentators refer to it, is exclusionary or predatory conduct, as opposed to luck, skill, or foresight. If a position in a marketplace, even if it's deemed to convey monopoly power on a defendant, is not unlawful if it is a result of luck, skill, or foresight. And so it is only a narrow, I would say, and I think the courts would say, group of conduct that a monopolist engages in that's illegal, and that's exclusionary or predatory conduct. And what is exclusionary or predatory conduct? It is conduct that has two elements. First, it, in effect, imposes costs, I think technically maybe the best way to think of it, imposes costs generally on competition, not just a competitor, but competition broadly, that may drive competition out of the market, that may increase the cost of competition staying in the market and competing, gaining access to consumers, that sort of thing. And two, this is the second element, that the conduct has no legitimate business justification. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that essentially we don't really do a balancing test. And let me just give you an example of predatory pricing where in some recent Supreme Court cases, the court has clarified the doctrine. And it really, that has two elements that sort of translate these two factors into a test for predatory pricing. First, the prices have to be below some measure of cost. Okay, now that's the question of whether or not there's a legitimate business justification. Because normally, in fact, invariably, at least under economic theory, if you know what marginal cost is and you've truly incorporated all costs into the calculation and all sources of revenue, no rational profit maximizer charges prices that are below cost. And therefore, you can think of the below cost test as in some ways being an evaluation of whether or not this pricing conduct has some justification, is legitimate. But then the second aspect of the test that the court really articulated in the Brook group case, but has also been in others, is the notion that there is a likelihood of recoupment. Because after all, in predatory pricing and all these other types of conduct, the threat is, again, restriction of output, raising prices to consumers. And if, under the circumstances of the market, it's impossible to imagine that after this conduct is over, the defendant would be able to raise prices and recoup its investment in predation, then there really is no exclusion or predation, no, in effect, driving competition at large out of the market, because competition will still be there, entry is still possible, and while there may be harm to individual competitors, there is no harm to competition. But you can go through each case, I would say, in recent years, and each type of conduct, and show that those two standards, the need to show that you've imposed costs or foreclosed competition from the market and lack of business justification, exists. And it's not a balancing test either, because it's impossible, frankly, to balance those two things. Conduct that may, in fact, make a product better, more attractive to consumers, may, in fact, make it more difficult for competitors to compete. But how do you trade that off? How do you say that, okay, it was a legitimate business justification to do that conduct, it did expand the defendant's output, but competitors were harmed, and therefore we're going to deny consumers some benefit in order to protect some element of competition. Courts generally have not done that and probably shouldn't. Finally, let me just say, in the standard, it is an objective standard. You can't look at the subjective intent of the individuals engaging in the conduct and draw any conclusions. Because, as I said, what we depend on is the profit-maximizing incentives or motivations of individual firms to fuel the economy. And that fuel is, in effect, provided by the notion that if I succeed, maybe I will be the only competitor in the market, and maybe I will be able to earn high rents for my good conduct. And if you look at individual competitors' motivations, the desire to crush a competitor, the desire to gain market share, is equally consistent with legitimate competition on the merits that has a justification as it is with any exclusionary conduct. And that's why, frankly, over the last 20 years, court after court has essentially rejected that evidence as being of really any relevance in a Section 2 claim. Now let me go to the Microsoft case. Essentially, there are, as Bert mentioned, four claims. One has to do with the so-called tie-in, the other has to do with the exclusive contracts, the third and fourth are the monopolization, attempted monopolization claim. But don't get confused, because the monopolization and attempted monopolization claims are largely based on the first two claims. The reason they brought a tie-in claim is, frankly, because they were hoping to get the benefit of a per se rule, and unlike what Bert said, even if the Court of Appeals decision applies, which I think it does, so that the government cannot prove that Internet functionality and Windows 98 and the underlying operating system are separate products, but rather are a single product, and therefore they can't prove a per se illegal tie-in, that doesn't mean that conduct of a computer company is beyond review under the antitrust laws. It simply means that the plaintiff has to prove the standard that I talked about, that competition is truly harmed and that there's no legitimate justification for the conduct. Under that standard, though, frankly, and the reason I believe the government brought it as a tie-in claim, they know they can't prevail. And again, when the Court of Appeals decision came out, their arguments for why Internet functionality and the underlying operating system are separate products pretty much got blown out of the water, and the evidence they provided in this case is identical to the arguments and the affidavits that they basically put in the consent decree case and the arguments that the Court of Appeals rejected. So I think they probably, and most people I think would agree, they're going to have a real difficult time on that first claim. Second issue are the exclusive practices. Now it is true that Microsoft by and large has stopped doing those things. There are actually legitimate justifications for them. The practices were not exclusionary in the sense of Microsoft told ISPs, Internet service providers or Internet content providers, they couldn't distribute anybody else's software. It was simply exclusive distribution, that if you participated in certain programs with Microsoft, you had to promote only Microsoft's browsing solution. But again, if you look at whether or not it had any exclusionary impact, at a period from October of 96 to October of 97, when all these practices were in effect, Netscape's number of users increased from $40 million to $65 million. And from late 97 through early 99, Netscape was embarked on a program they called Netscape Everywhere to essentially distribute 150 million copies of their internet software. And on the eve of the trial, the month before the trial, Netscape reported that 12.4 million computer users had downloaded Netscape's browser software, which was several times the number of copies of Windows 98 that were sold during the same period. So as a practical matter, it's hard to say that Netscape was excluded from the market. It is true that Microsoft was increasing its user base at a faster rate, so that by early 98, pretty much it had drawn even with Netscape in terms of users. But it had done that not through any contractual practices, but because it improved its product. It worked the old-fashioned way. It as it went from IE 1.0 technologies to 2.0, and then really the 3.0 and 4.0, the technology got much better reviews. It was viewed as being more desirable to independent software vendors who wanted to make their software compatible with the internet. And essentially, frankly, a lot of users who really were new to computing and to the internet found it easier to use Microsoft's technology. And so again, it's simply a reflection of Microsoft getting its product out, getting it disseminated widely, but not in any way excluding Netscape from the marketplace. And I think the evidence is pretty clear on both of those counts, and the government's going to have a very difficult time. Finally, with respect to the broader claim, because what happened was that was essentially the complaint when we started off. The government said they were just attacking these contractual provisions, and it was a narrow case. But after the Court of Appeals decision, I believe after the evidence came in on discovery, they expanded their strategy. They expanded their case. They started bringing in, for example, the so-called June 21st, 1995 meeting between Netscape and Microsoft, where the government now claims Microsoft invited Netscape to divide the browser market. Again, without boring you, but I'd be happy to talk later about it, if you look at the one precedent that exists out there, United States versus American Airlines, the so-called Crandall case, for condemning an invitation to an agreement that doesn't actually result in an agreement, the standards are very high for a plaintiff to prove that, to carry its burden. At the very least, they have to show that there's an unequivocal invitation to a per se unlawful or unjustified agreement. And if you look at the June 21st meeting, it's very ambiguous as to what was going on. It involved Microsoft executives who were not in a position to bind the company and who, according to Jim Barksdale, never actually said, let's divide the market. And finally, it was in a context where Microsoft was, at Netscape's invitation, discussing a range of cooperation, standard setting, technology sharing, that essentially, if you were to condemn those sorts of discussions, you would pretty much dam up all of the discussions that are key to the kind of cooperation and interrelationships that prevail in Silicon Valley today and are necessary for the movement of the industry. Well, I don't have much time. I have a matter of seconds. I want to just say two things. First, with respect to remedies, I will listen attentively to what the speakers have to say, but I will make one comment, and that is that if you look at judicially imposed structural relief, the last time a court, to my knowledge, but maybe Bill can correct me, the last time a court imposed such relief was in the late 60s. It's true that AT&T agreed to relief in the early 80s, but that was a very unique case, and frankly, AT&T wanted it because they were concerned about continuation of having regulators use their long-distance revenues to subsidize local telephone companies and local, local telephone consumers. And so from their perspective, it made business sense. But it's very unusual for courts to impose the remedy. With perhaps one exception, the remedy is only imposed in cases where, essentially like in Standard Oil, you have the conglomeration of previously separate companies and you have the spinoff of their stock. It has never, there might be one exception to what I'm about to say, but even that exception does not establish that it's viable. A case where a court has gone in and taken a company that is really an indivisible whole and tried to break it up. So I think a lot of the remedies that are being discussed that are rather extreme, one, are inconsistent with what the government asked for in its complaint and originally proposed, and two, are sufficiently radical in terms of a precedent that I don't think at the end of the day will prevail. And then finally, let me just reiterate what I said at the outset about what is at stake. I think that in order for the government to prevail, they really are going to have to sort of reduce their burden for showing that there's actual harm to competition or harm to consumer welfare. They haven't really been able in the case to put in any evidence on that. Second, I think they're going to have to get a court to agree to raise the bar in terms of what a company shows for legitimate business justification. And finally, I think they're going to have to get a court to ignore some of the learning over the last 20 years about a more fulsome approach to the question of market power and monopoly power and the things that are relevant in evaluating it. And I think if they succeed, then not only will it have serious and, I believe, adverse effects on this industry, but it frankly will open up a new vista for enforcement opportunities for plaintiff actions, which is good for me as an antitrust lawyer and good for any of you out there who are aspiring antitrust lawyers. But in that great wider world that's out there, I think it's probably bad news for consumers and bad news for the economy. Thank you.